This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is big band leader, clarinetist, and saxophonist Woody Herman, who's celebrating his 50th anniversary as a band leader. That's Woody Herman's 1945 recording of his composition, Apple Honey. Herman became a band leader during the swing era. Many of his contemporaries gave up their bands after World War II, when the economics of jazz made it difficult to support a large group, and the rhythmic and harmonic innovations of bebop made swing sound dated. But Herman kept up with modern jazz, and he stuck with the band in spite of the financial difficulties. At 73, he's one of the only band leaders of his generation who's still touring with his band on a regular basis. Herman has spent most of his life on the road. His first band was called The Band That Plays the Blues. His subsequent bands have been known as The Herds. One of his greatest accomplishments as a leader has been selecting outstanding soloists and arrangers. Stan Getz, Zoot Sims, Al Cohn, Jimmy Drewfree, Shorty Rogers, and Ralph Burns all received their first national recognition as part of Herman's band. Woody Herman started his performing career as a tap dancer when he was 9. He added pop music to his act and was billed as the boy wonder of the clarinet. He told me about getting started in show business at such a young age.
First of all, my father taught me to sing or make noise. And that was really, I was a song and dance kid. And then with the money I made from the first or second road tour, I've forgotten, I got my first saxophone and then later a clarinet and started to study with local teachers in Milwaukee.
Had you heard jazz then?
No, I didn't hear jazz really or become aware of it until I got into the teenage stage of life. I think I was about 13 or 14 when I entered high school.
So what were you initially playing on the saxophone that you bought?
Oh, things that were popular for the saxophone. Hits of the day or something written by Rudy Weedoff, the first impresario of the saxophone.
Were you still in school, or did you like tour and have a tutor? How did that work?
No, it worked out pretty well because I made a decision when I was 10 years old to leave public school, and I entered a parochial school in Milwaukee, St. John's Cathedral. Of my own accord, I was not advised by my parents about this, but I felt that I would have more freedom in a parochial school. They would understand why I was trying to do something.
And so they were tolerant of your cutting out sometimes to
Well, they would
to
let
perform.
Me go, and I'd have to continue my work while I was traveling on the road, and they would make tests up for me and see that I was actually working.
What were the early bands like that you played with?
I think the one I got a job while I was in my first year of high school with probably the best house band in the Midwest. It was a house band in the Million Dollar Eagles Ballroom in Milwaukee, and the leader's name was Joey Lichter. Most of the musicians in the band were mature people, and most of them had come to Milwaukee from Chicago, where they had long musical careers. So I was in the midst of a group of people that at least were musically adequate.
Is that where you got the billing Boy Wonder of the Clarinet?
No, I still did that, got that billing while I was doing theaters. But when I announced to my mother and father that I was no longer in showbiz and that I was leaving it forever and I was about to embark on a jazz musician's career, I think they both went into a dead faint because as long as I was in the theater, that seemed safe to them. But being a jazz musician, just like the word jazz, was thought of as a very bad, dirty kind of thing.
This is amazing. First of all, so many parents wouldn't want their kids in showbiz because they think that was unsafe.
Yes.
And then your parents didn't want you in jazz. So
I think everybody has a different concept of what success is.
How did you start that first band? You had been playing with the Isham Jones band.
Isham Jones band. I was with them. And when he retired, there were six of us all together, five others and me. And we decided to band together, stick together, and become a cooperative group, and much as rock groups do today, which is rather strange, I think.
Was it financially cooperative?
Yes. The fellows that went into the thing with me were stockholders, just as I was, and I was voted to stand in front of the band.
Were you one of the youngest members of the band?
Now that I think back about it, yeah.
How come you were the one who was chosen to front the band?
Because of my showbiz career background. Yeah, I'm sure of that because I wasn't a slick player at that point, but I was adequate and I knew how to talk to an audience and how to handle people. And that's why the guys voted me in.
What kind of material were you playing then? That band was dubbed the band that played the blues.
Right, and that the reason for the billing we gave ourselves was because we felt that we played blues probably better than some other kind of music. And so we concentrated on that to a great extent.
I want to play Woodchopper's Ball, which you recorded
1939.
Yeah. Okay. And this is with the band that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's the band that plays the blues, yeah.
Do you want to say anything about this recording before we hear it?
Well, it was what we, in those days and still do, call a head arrangement. The music was written for it after we recorded it.
Okay.
You follow me?
Right, I got it. Okay, my guest is Woody Herman, and this is his 1939 recording of Woodchopper's Ball. Woody Herman and his band recorded in 1939. That was Woodchopper's Ball. My guest is Woody Herman. You're still including that in your repertoire, right?
Oh, yeah. Anything I'm guilty of, we play.
You've said that when you started leading the band, you thought of yourself as a coach.
Right.
What did you mean by that?
I mean that I like to handle guys and make them, put them in a better light if I can, as far as their soloing ability and their all-around musicianship. And if I can do that, then I feel I'm making a good team, and that's why I consider myself a coach.
Do you think of yourself as a psychologist at all? I mean, like using psychology to try to bring out the best of what someone has to offer?
Only in music. I have refused, even in my earliest years, to try to be a mentor for guys with their love life or anything else.
Did they expect you to be that since you were the leader?
Sometimes they would ask me questions, and I said, "You're on your own, man. You know, you're a man, and so am I."
What do you think of as being the distinctive qualities that that make and have made your bands yours and give it your band sound?
Well, I think mainly it stems from the players themselves, because I tried always to get the best players and then give them a free hand and a free head and try to help to develop their abilities.
There's a lot of musicians that really got started in your band, and just to tick off a few, Stan Getz, Al Cohn, Zoot Sims, Jimmy Giuffre.
Right. The Four Brothers were some of the people that later came on the scene.
What do you look for? How do you audition someone? Let's start with the 30s and 40s. How did you then go about finding people?
Then it was really less difficult if there was somebody that you really liked. And if they were working for someone else, you try to get them to join your band, because you were trying to play new things and probably more musical things. And those that wanted to progress joined us. And I think that was a big come on as far as guys were concerned.
The band that you led in the 30s and the early 40s, mm-hmm. you described as a cooperative band that was an offshoot of the Isham Jones band. What was the first band that you really thought of as being yours?
Well, let me tell you why that band was changed, and there was a kind of a different kind of evolution took place, but it was because of wartime. And as people were drafted out and went into the service, we had to get different kind of people, or new people, or people who we thought would work for us. And then I decided that it was now my sole responsibility, and I wanted to do more progressive music than we were doing in the earliest days. And I wanted to improve. I wanted the band to improve and be one that could play all kinds of music and do it well.
You left the road for, I think it was 7 months or something like that,
that
in 1946.
That was my brief respite. I did it because I had a new family, and we had a new home in California, and I hadn't been there very much at all. So I wanted to spend some time with my daughter and my wife. So that's the reason that there was a hiatus.
It was a long one for you, but a short one measured by anybody else,
yeah,
I think.
I'm
it was 7
so.
Months.
And then after 7 months, I heard a trumpet player that really turned me around. His name was Ernie Royal, and Marshall Royal, and he were brothers. And he had a fabulous range, and he had ability to utilize that range musically. And so I became infatuated with his sound. And then Jimmy Giuffre's convincing me that he could put together a new sound with saxophones. So he was responsible for the Four Brothers.
Was it hard to leave your family after settling down for the first time in a long time, even if it was only
a few
months?
Well, I suppose it was difficult, but the music was very important then, just as it still is now.
So Jimmy Giuffre put together the reed section that became known as the Four Brothers.
It was his basic idea, and they were... All but the baritone player, Serge Shaloff, were in California at the time, in Southern California. They mostly slept and ate music, and they were on the beach every day, jamming and playing, you know. And together they created this sound.
So the sound was comprised of 3 tenor saxophonists and one baritone saxophonist. Was that an unusual configuration for a big
band? Yes, other people had fooled with it, but I think we were the first ones to pull it off.
What's unusual about it?
Well, you don't have any altos, and that's the highest sound in saxophone station, so it has, to me, a more mellow sound. But a lot of society and Mickey Mouse bands use the tenor sound, but over-exaggerating the vibrato and so forth, and to give it a corny sound. And we tried not to do that. In other words, it was the subtlety of a Lester Young sound that our saxophones were doing at that point.
Another thing that made that band unique was that it was a big band that was playing harmonies and rhythms that came out of bop. And I right. think a lot of the big bands really were resisting
that. They weren't
that.
Interested, and I was. So, as a matter of fact, our whole band, shortly before we went into the second herd, if you want to call it that, the Four Brothers herd, I had insisted that our whole band, before my hiatus, that we would go to hear Charlie Parker at his opening on 52nd Street with Dizzy and a few of our friends, because Dizzy was already writing for our band.
Was it hard to figure out how to incorporate the rhythmic and harmonic innovations of bop into a big band setting?
Well, I think you had to have imagination, and I think that you... in other words, there's two kinds of music, as Ellington said many times, and certainly Stravinsky said it to me personally. Two kinds of music, good and bad, and we were definitely trying to play good.
I'd like to play one of the recordings that the band we're talking about, the second herd, recorded, and this is the piece called Four Brothers. That's that really shows off the instrumentation that we were talking about. It was written by
Jimmy
Giuffre.
It was the first thing different. It was revolutionary for a big band to be doing this, yes.
Let's listen to it. This was, do you remember the year this was recorded in?
The date?
Yeah, do you remember?
No, but it was in 47, beginning of 47, because that's, the band had just been rehearsing, and we were still rehearsing. We hadn't gone on the road yet when we made this record.
Okay, so this is Woody Herman and the Second Herd. Thank you. It's the Woody Herman Band, the second Heard, recorded in 1947. That was four brothers. And that still sounds great. And I'm sure you're also still playing.
We're still playing, yeah. And we have done several versions since then with all sorts of saxophone players.
The second Heard, which was your second band, you organized that in 46 or 47.
47.
And this was just about the time that a lot of the big bands were
That's
starting to
That's when they
fold.
All disappeared, yeah.
Yeah, so you were really going against the tide then by organizing a big band. Yeah.
Well, everybody left except Ellington, Basie, and maybe Harry James. And everyone else just took a run for it, and mostly. And
was it hard to keep the bands going? Is that why so many of them disappeared?
Yeah, well, financially it was a bust. It was no longer a business. It was now a hobby, and if you could afford it, you did it.
How were you able to do it?
Because I made it a hobby. And I've suffered the consequences ever since, you know. I got into trouble later with the IRS, and I'm still in trouble with them at this late date.
You once said that what would have made the best financial sense would have been after 1946 or so to take your money and invest it, not invest it in a band,
but
invest it.
Yeah, oh, of course, yeah.
But obviously you've put music first.
Well, it's been above everything in my lifetime, so sometimes it's been a disservice to me as a person. But that's beside the point, because I still have that love and affection for music, and I'm still alive, I think, because of my love for music. And the Lord has been kind to me. Let's look at it that way.
I think you've been very self-effacing in a way as a soloist. Would you have liked to be better known as a soloist?
No. I never had any great desire about that. I wanted to be okay and not get in anybody's way, and maybe I could even add something on occasion. That's what I did.
You've said that you've never thought of yourself as a great clarinetist. How do you feel about the instrument?
I don't like the instrument. I don't think I ever did. I think it's a very difficult, too difficult instrument to express yourself properly.
If you dislike the clarinet so much, how come you played it? Because you also were a saxophonist.
Well, it was the American boys' instrument in the 30s and 40s. You know, it was if you didn't have a clarinet and stood in front of a band, well, what are you there for? It was almost at that point.
Igor Stravinsky in the mid-40s wrote a concerto, the Ebony Concerto, for
yes.
you and your band. Right. That must have been very demanding to learn how to play.
It was, and it was difficult for all of us, but I think my part was the most grotesque of anyone's. And I think that was part of the Stravinsky plan, because it's extremely well-written piece and so well. But the solos that were written were very difficult for the trumpet solo and tenor and the clarinet was impossible.
Did Stravinsky help you out with it at all?
He was there to conduct it when we rehearsed it in the beginning, yes, in 1946.
Was that intimidating?
It was. to all of us. And after I remember the very first rehearsal, first place, the guys were all dressed in different unusual costumes than they would wear for everyday wear, because they were going to be with the world's greatest living composer at that point. And they were all, they looked like businessmen or something. And Stravinsky came running in the last minute from the airport and was wearing a gray sweatshirt and a pair of slacks and tennis shoes. And had a towel around his neck, so I think he was more relaxed than we were. And the first rehearsal was very scary to all of us. We were nervous. Even if we could play it better, we couldn't play better right at that moment. And yet after an hour and maybe 20 minutes of rehearsal, Stravinsky put his arm around me and said, "Woody, you have a beautiful family." And that's his way of describing the feeling that he got from the young players who wanted to play this so desperately.
Did you have a great feeling of accomplishment once you learned the piece and performed it? And
yeah,
it went
well, I was nervous right to the bitter performance, but I'll tell you, it gave me a whole different attitude about many things, because it put me head and shoulders above, at least for that moment, with the rest of my world, the big band world, because Benny had proven his point that he was a great clarinetist, and classically and in jazz, but I had never proven anything as far as I was concerned except having a great band. And so that's what I tried to do, and I received, it put me in a new position. I was now respected by a lot of people who didn't know whether I was good or bad.
You had a club in New Orleans at the Hyatt Regency mm-hmm. for about a year,
right.
I guess. And mm-hmm. When was that?
It was 1981.
How come you gave that up?
I gave it up because it was financially a bust, and all the backers I had were no longer being backers, and so it would have been. But more important, my wife became ill, really ill, and I couldn't be there and be in Hollywood at the same time, so I went home.
She died that year, and it was
after
I guess, 40 years of marriage.
46.
46 years of marriage. It's really quite incredible, I think, for a marriage to last that long with a performer.
Well, I think for a jazz musician, she made it a world's record. She never lost faith in me, and I was very proud and very much in love with this lady for a long, long time.
You went back on the road afterwards?
Yeah. As long as you are on the road, and really the road, hard running together one-nighters and paying your dues, you have musical freedom that you can't have any other way. You can't go anywhere in the world and decide to become a solid citizen there one way or another and still keep your music inspiration, because you will be required to play the music someone else wants you to play in order to make a livelihood from this. And when you're in that position, then I think you realize the main reason for being on the road.
And it's freedom.
It's freedom, complete freedom, because you're only in one place for a few hours, then you're next day you're in another place. You don't have to answer for anything that someone says to you other than you felt it was a good step.
That was bandleader, clarinetist, and saxophonist Woody Herman, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.